We're broadcasting.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Monday, March 1st. We have three public hearings on our agenda today. And for those of you who are waiting to hear those or participate in them, I do plan on calling them in the order that they are printed on the agenda. House Bill 2028, then 2429, then HJR 13. Before we start with that, could we please have the roll call?
Representative Hernandez is absent.
Absent.
Representative Levy.
Present by video.
Representative Marsh.
Excused, and she will be joining us in just a few minutes.
Representative Smith is excused. Vice Chair Pham.
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke present by video.
And Madam Chair Nathanson.
Present by video. We have a quorum. Thank you, everyone. So just a few housekeeping things. For those people who will be presenting testimony, it's helpful if you keep your video camera off and your microphone off until you're called on. It helps reduce the background noise for the people who are speaking, and then it's a clearer audio for people listening. Mr. Alanak, is there anything before I open the first public hearing?
I don't think so, Madam Chair. I think you're good to
go. Okay. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2028. Please present the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2028 is a bill that requires or eases the process for cities to receive state shared revenues. And it removes the requirement for them to enact an ordinance signaling their intent to do so. It also adds to statute a definition of consolidated property taxes for purpose of the state revenue sharing. It establishes a timeline for the Department of Administrative Services to determine the amount of property taxes that are due to the cities in that revenue sharing agreement. And it eliminates obsolete statute references. And I believe that the Department of Administrative Services has someone signed up to testify to provide some more information.
Indeed, thank you. Committee, any questions for LRO before we call on our witnesses? Okay. The only person signed up to testify so far is Adam Crawford. Manny, do we have any other names since that?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Adam Crawford, please.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Reschke and Pham, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Adam Crawford, here today representing the Department of Administrative Services. As committee staff has laid out for you, I doubt House Bill 2028 will be the most politically charged bill if you get this legislative session, but we do think it makes an important improvement to a significant area of the law. To give you some background on the bill, as the committee knows, the state of Oregon collects taxes on a series of items, including cigarettes, marijuana, alcohol, gasoline, things of this nature. Some of these revenues that the state otherwise collects is designated to go back to local governments. It is the Department of Administrative Services' job to make sure that that happens on a quarterly basis. The way we do that, and the way otherwise prescribed by law, is local governments have to file with DAS a ordinance or a resolution by July 31st of every year to ensure, essentially attesting that they will use the revenues as otherwise prescribed by law. But we need this resolution or ordinance prior to sending any quarterly distributions. For 95% of the local governments we work with, this system works just fine. The problem arises for the roughly 5% or so that don't. These are mostly smaller governments, smaller cities. that if the wrong person retires, or if the city council can't find a quorum, or if they otherwise have not taken up the opportunity to pass that resolution or ordinance, it creates these in a series of administrative problems. These administrative problems run into more practical ones when those cities have otherwise budgeted these funds to be used as one would might otherwise imagine. The bill before you today, Section 1, describes a world in which the staff member responsible for the appropriation of these funds, for most cities, this would be either a city manager or city recorder. For some larger cities, this would be a finance director, would simply attest with that to DAS that they would use the funds as otherwise prescribed by law. A relatively simple fix, we believe. However, there is a problem with the bill, and that is found in Section 2 of the measure. So Section 2 of the measure deals with certain audit requirements. Also, as the committee may know, municipal governments are required by law to every year produce a municipal audit report and submit that to the Secretary of State. We as DAS are required to, if that municipal government or if a municipal government does not produce an audit report, to withhold 10% of the money we otherwise would send them until that audit report comes in. Section 2 was prompted by the city of Chiloquin. In 2020, the city of Chiloquin was a little late getting their municipal audit report in, as we as DAS had to withhold 10% of their otherwise distributed funds from them. This was less than $50. This was made a little more confusing even still because it wasn't actually the city of Chiloquin's fault. There's only so many municipal audit shops in the state that do this kind of work, and our understanding was their vendor just missed a deadline and was a few weeks late. So what this required us to do, the Secretary of State was paying to let them know that the municipal audit was not completed. We were paying to withhold the 10%. We went through a series of steps to make sure that it was the case. 3 weeks later, after the municipal audit was completed, we undid all the steps we did to withhold the 10%, and less than $50 was sent to the city of Chiloquin. In my haste, my policy prescription for this was simply remove the authority from the Department of Administrative Services for withholding this 10%. However, in consultation with the Secretary of State's municipal audit team, their concern was by doing so, we remove any sort of compliance mechanism from these statutes. So my request for the committee, if it would meet with the chair's approval, is to remove Section 2 from the law or from this current measure and then leave it to the League of Oregon Cities, the Secretary of my state, myself, to go away in the summer to come up with a workout that actually works for all three parties. So with that, I just wanted to take a quick moment also to thank the League of Oregon Cities and all their finance folks for looking at the measure. If for whatever reason there's some language in there that does not meet with their needs, happy to work with them to find something that does. With that, happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Crawford, good to see you. So your fix is to have, you said the Secretary of State's Audit Division, League of Oregon Cities, and DAS go off in the summer. So what you're asking for is to pass the bill with Section 1, no Section 2, and then 2022 come back with the fix that all of you agree. Is that correct?
Chair Nathanson and Vice Chair Reschke, that's correct. We would need an amendment to remove Section 2, and then we can come up with a consensus solution, hopefully either in 2022 or 2023.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? I think that sounds like a fine solution. Mr. Allenack, can you initiate the drafting of an amendment for us to consider?
Yes, Madam Chair, we'll take care of that.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments on House Bill 2028 before I close the public hearing? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Crawford, so just in thinking about this, is there any danger that we're in? Do we cause a problem by only passing Section 1 and not having a fix in this year or two that we'd be waiting for the fix?
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Reschke, I think it's a great question. I don't think so. I think what we would otherwise continue on with the existing statute. There would be some additional administrative headache with this kind of removing the 10% and then adding it back. It's a little bit of a headache for my finance folks as we go back with the Secretary of State to make sure we're complying with the state law. But in this case, I'd want to make sure we get something that's right for all three parties rather than to try to do it quickly. I hope that answers your question.
It does. Thank you, Mr. Crawford. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anyone else? I'm getting ready to close the public hearing. Okay, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2028. And a process issue for those of you watching, in case you're trying to gauge the progress of the committee's work, we're on the second of three bills. House Bill 2429 has five, it could be more, but at least five persons signed up to testify. And we will hear that bill before we hear HJR 13. I am now opening a public hearing on House Bill 2429.
Thank you, Madam. Members of the committee, I'm going to share my screen. I have a very brief presentation with some information for the committee about this bill. The bill deals with the corporate activity tax and makes some adjustments, or I would say probably technical fixes to the bill that I'll describe. My screen should be showing now. I hope that it is. I can't see the full team screen, so please stop me if there are any questions. As most of you are familiar with, Oregon's corporate activity tax was passed during the 2019 session. I've given a brief description of each of the parameters related to the tax here, just for your reference. The tax is based on commercial activity, and that's defined within statute. The rate of the tax is 0.57%. The threshold for that rate to be applied is $1 million in commercial activity. The tax is equal to $1 million multiplied by that 0.57% plus $250. There is a subtraction as part of this, as part of the cap, and it allows businesses to subtract 35% of either their employee labor costs or their cost of goods sold. There's also a selected exclusion of retail and wholesale groceries, as well as fuel. And also, there is a 15% subtraction allowed for builders of single-family residential homes for subcontracting costs. And the effective date was January 1, 2020. And so on the next slide, I've outlined section by section what the bill does to change statute. And the majority of these changes that I want to draw your attention to that aren't simply effective dates or applicability dates are in sections 1 or 2. So section 1, the bill adds language indicating that commercial activity does not include the following two things. The first is the exchange of new vehicles between franchised motor vehicle dealerships. I believe the intent of the original bill was to exclude transfers of vehicles across dealerships between entities so that there isn't actually a sale taking place there, and so there's no commercial activity to be taxed. This is a clarifying change to align better with that intent. The second point here is that groceries were intended to be exempt in the CAT. And I believe there has been some testimony or industry stakeholders have come forward saying that groceries sold by a consignee or a consignment store operator should also not be taxed by the CAT. So there's still some ongoing discussions around the language related to groceries, but the intent was not to tax grocery sales. And so potentially we have a change there. And then section 2 makes a change to the language allowing vehicle dealers to collect the estimated portion of the tax on leases of vehicles, not just the sale of vehicles. And then the other sections of the bill define the applicability provisions, or defines the applicability date, excuse me, to be January 1, 2022. And the effective date is 91 days following the adjournment, signee die. And then very briefly, I just for your reference included a list of the issues that came up during a Senate hearing on Senate Bill 164, which is the Senate version of this bill. So I'll go through these quickly, but also I think some of the testimony today will describe these in more detail. And so I'm going to go at a high level, but happy to answer any questions. The first point is the intent of provisions with respect to groceries and the transfer of new vehicles that I described in the previous slide. The second discussion point was related to pharmacies. I think there's been ongoing discussion about pharmacies and their ability to raise prices or lack of ability potentially for pharmaceuticals. And so there's been some discussion around that and stakeholders describing difficulties associated with that. And then the Department of Revenue, I believe, will be testifying on a couple of technical changes or clarifications. The first is deals with penalties, both penalties for underpayment and tax administration. Underpayment and the failure to file penalties in statute. There's also a desire for some clarification, specifically with respect to the net revenue of residential care facilities, excuse me. When the cap was passed, net revenue is not the same thing necessarily as commercial activity or gross receipts, and so there's a desire for some clarification there regarding legislative intent. And then finally, with respect to business closures or sales, current law requires the taxpayer to file within 45 days of the closure and also pay the tax due within that 45-day period. But the department thinks, I believe, based on their testimony, that this is administratively burdensome for taxpayers. And so the idea within the discussion surrounding this bill and within the Senate committee discussion is to change that payment due date and the filing deadline till April 15th of the following year. And that is all I had as a brief overview. So I will unshare my screen. And I am, of course, happy to answer any questions.
I'm going to ask just one question before we start calling on witnesses. Some of what you just described to us about the Senate committee discussion of a parallel bill doesn't relate to the language of the bill and the statutory changes that are being proposed. It's just other issues that came up while people happen to be talking about the cat. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct, Madam Chair. Just provided for background, but not part of the amendments. And the slide previous to that goes through the only changes that are actually in the bill as you see it.
Okay, it's just other kinds of stuff that was on their mind. Okay.
Yeah, kind of background from that discussion might be relevant.
We're ready now, I think, for public testimony. Manny, do we have any names after the five that I have listed that I printed just prior to the meeting?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. We have five people testifying on this bill, we have a lot testifying on the next bill. So if you can keep your comments to around 3 or 4 minutes, that's appreciated. We won't be too hard and fast about it, but that should be adequate, I think. I'm going to tell you the order that I'm calling on you on. That I'll be calling on you so that you can prepare and get ready. It will be Ex-Ann Culver, followed by Marjorie Taylor, Bennett Minton, Billy Muzio, and Jeff Newgard. Okay, the first is Ex-Ann Culver.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson. I believe Marjorie would be beginning for us.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Marjorie Taylor, Legislative Director for the Department of Revenue. Thank you. Yes, Kate did a great job summarizing the provisions of House Bill 2429, as you know, approved in 2019, and the agency has had the opportunity to implement and identify some additional proposals for changes that Ex-Ann, our CAP policy advisor, will go through, and those are also identified in our written testimony available to the committee, but certainly only follow along with what Kate has already identified. Thank you. She's on mute.
Is Xan?
My apologies. I was on mute and talking away. Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Xan Culver with the Oregon Department of Revenue. And as Marjorie said, we do have testimony posted in OLIS that lists out some additional technical issues that we've identified in the administration of the corporate activity tax that we would like to bring to your attention. So because that testimony is posted, I will just briefly describe those issues here. During the first special session in 2020, House Bill 4202 modified the underpayment penalty provisions, and those are underpayments of estimated taxes that are required quarterly throughout the year. And those revised provisions now treat taxpayers differently based on when they file their returns for the 2020 and 2021 tax years. Some taxpayers are required to pay at least 80% of those required estimated payments, and others are required to pay at least 90%. So for example, a taxpayer who files their 2021 tax return, which is due April 15th, 2022, if they file it on April 10th, 2022, they must have paid 80% of the required estimated payments in order to avoid that underpayment penalty. Where a taxpayer who requests an extension to file the return would normally be due on April 15th, we approve an extension for them to file later in the year, up to 6 months later. If they file on June 1st of 2022, they must have paid at least 90% of those required estimated payments to avoid the underpayment penalty. And that's because the change in the statutory language applies the penalty for underpayment not equal to 80% or more for returns filed on or before April 15th, and then requiring 90% for returns filed after April 15th. And that would be in the year of 2022. The bill, House Bill 4202, also added explicit application of failure to file penalties. And because this additional language is different than in other statute, it blurs whether the regular application of standard tax administration penalties would apply here. So it would be more clear if that language were to be repealed. And again, in our written testimony, we have examples of that. And then there's just two remaining issues that I want to bring to your attention from the original legislation. And as Kate had described, one of those is that taxpayers who sell or close their business are required to file their final tax return within 45 days of the closure or sale. And that's not consistent with other annual tax programs, and it may create a burden for those taxpayers to comply. And then the last piece is that there is an exclusion for net revenue of a residential care facility or in-home care agencies, but it isn't clear what net revenue is because the CAT is based on receipts. So that is all that we have for you today. I want to thank you for the opportunity to bring these to your attention and for consideration. And either Marjorie or I would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for these two? Let's move on to the next speaker. Can you stay around with us? Please stay around. Thanks. The next speaker is Bennett Minton.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, once again, can you hear me?
Yes.
Very good. My name is Bennett Minton. I'm appearing on behalf of Tax Fairness Oregon, a network of volunteers who support a rational and equitable tax code. HB 2429 appears to allow logical amendments to the corporate activity tax, changes that are in keeping with the original design. We have no objection, notwithstanding any of these technical issues that have been presented. We are concerned with other bills that would undermine the tax regime and shortchange the purposes for which it was enacted. So we just want to make note that we will oppose measures that would create loopholes in the CAT. And based on experience, it will be an ongoing task to counter both those who cry that their idea is justified and those who seek the CAT's death by a thousand cuts. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the testimony. Next is Billy Muzio.
Yes, Madam Chair. So good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Billy Muzio, and I'm an independent operator for Grocery Outlet. I am an owner of my own small business, and I contract with Grocery Outlet to operate their store located in Bend, Oregon. I'm here this afternoon to support House Bill 2429 from the independent operator's perspective, who contract with Grocery Outlet and operate their stores. I moved my family to Bend, Oregon, October 1st, 2016, to purchase, own, and operate the Bend Grocery Outlet. Our store serves the public 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m., helping families afford groceries at a discount price. Many of my customers are underprivileged and are looking to obtain the highest quality of products at the lowest possible price. All Grocery Outlet stores in Oregon are operated by small mom-and-pop businesses called independent operators who contract with Grocery Outlet to operate the stores in exchange for a small share of the profits. Essentially, we sell on consignment. When the CAT tax was written and passed, it was understood that groceries were excluded from the tax, which we support. However, as a result of Grocery Outlet's business model and the independent store operators were responsible for the tax, which was not the intention of the original legislation. Our business model is unique. All of us Oregon mom and pops operate on consignment. Our business model allows us to deliver superior customer service, personalized to each of the local communities that we serve. We do not own the product. We sell the product at a small portion of the profits, yet under the current legislation are responsible for 100% of the tax bill. One of the most challenging aspects with the current legislation is sellers of groceries have to separately track sales of products that meet the definition of food under SNAP from sales of products that do not meet this definition. For small grocery stores such as myself, this is not an easy task. Given our unique problem, we support and encourage you to pass the technical fix to House Bill 2429 to ensure the groceries that independent operators sell to the public are exempt from the CAT as originally intended. Thank you, and I would be glad to answer any of your questions that you may have.
Thank you for the testimony. Committee, any questions for Mr. Muzio? Thank you for being with us. The final speaker is Jeff Newsgard.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Reschke, and FAM members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Newsgard, representing the Smart Growth Coalition. We are a consortium of traded sector businesses with significant investments in jobs and capital projects in Oregon. Our comments today are brief, but we wanted to notify you of an amendment we're working on in collaboration with the Department of Revenue and Legislative Revenue Office. We're looking to address a significant administrative and compliance issue relating to the tax year for the CAT. Current law requires taxpayers to account their commercial activity during the calendar year. This is fairly straightforward for taxpayers paying their income taxes using calendar year accounting. However, roughly 40% of corporate taxpayers likely subject to the tax use non-calendar year accounting for their federal and state income taxes. The lack of alignment between the CAT and fiscal years will result in significant accounting hardships for both taxpayers and auditors. Our goal is to find a solution that allows non-calendar year taxpayers to use their fiscal year accounting for purposes of the CAT in the least disruptive way possible. We hope to be back soon with a proposal to share with you, and I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you.
Committee, any questions for Mr. Newsgard? Thank you for your testimony. Committee, any final questions for anyone, any of the witnesses or Legislative Revenue Office, or comments on what we've heard on this bill before I close this public hearing? I don't see any. All right, we're closing the public hearing on House Bill 2429. And I'm just confirming one final time that after the 9 names that I have printed for testimony on HJR 13, there are no additional names. At this time, I'm opening the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 13.
Madam Chair, do you want me to, I think Rep. Yes. Nose is, Rep. Nose, this is Chris Helenek. Rep. Nose is in the room?
He is here already. Okay, yes. I didn't see that. Thank you, Representative Nose.
All right, Madam Chair, can you hear me?
I can. You're first.
Okay. All right. Very good. All right. For the record, Chair Nathanson and members of your committee, my name is Rob Nose, and I am the state representative for House District 42, which consists of inner southeast Portland and a sliver of northeast Portland. And I have been a property tax nerd since I moved to Oregon in 1992. My job back then was to figure out how to mitigate 1990s ballot measure 5 on behalf of university students. And I guess, Madam Chair, I'm still at it, and I've decided to throw Measure 50 into the mix. I'm here to give some brief remarks in support of HJR 13, which will refer to the ballot an opportunity for the voters of our state to add to our Constitution a requirement that the ratio of maximum assessed value to real market value property must be equal to 0.75 or 75%. Now, colleagues, it is in my opinion that the understanding of the details of property tax is often inaccessible to the average Oregonian. The operations and administration of property taxes in our state and across the country, frankly, are complex. And I've spent a long time at this trying to retain my own understanding of the rate limitations and AV versus MV, and it's frankly not easy. So I'll do my best to explain this in a way that I think would make sense to the average Oregonian. After all, if there is a possibility that this resolution would be referred to a ballot, I need to be using language that makes sense so that voters and hopefully all of you understand what it is that we're attempting to do. So let me provide quick an overview of the differences between assessed value of a home and real market value of a home. The real market value of a home is what we see when we look up the value of a home in a real estate marketplace such as the website Zillow, okay? It is what is its actual value. The assessed value is the dollar value assigned to a property to measure applicable taxes. When Measure 50 was passed by the voters in 1997, actually it was Measure 47 back then, but I'll let somebody else get into that. This created a permanent property tax rate that was based on the newly created assessed value of home. It divorced our property tax system from considering the real market value of someone's home when determining their tax rates. As this permanent property tax rate has now existed for an extended period of time, it has created large disparities in how much Oregonians are paying in property taxes, often on properties that are very similar, and thus one of the main problems with how Measure 50 has played out over the decades. For example, there are two homes that are sold in Multnomah County, where I live, in the same time frame with nearly the same selling prices. But because of our property tax system, those homeowners pay drastically different amounts in property taxes annually. Home A, it sold for $749,000 in the year 2019. It had a real market value of $599,620. But it has an assessed value of $93,840. And the owners are only required to pay $2,378 in property taxes annually on that property, that house A. Now, home B, it sold for $755,000 in 2020, not that different from property A. It had a real market value of $517,180. And an assessed value of $517,180. And those owners are paying property taxes at $9,377 annually. Now, as you can hear, Madam Chair, if you weren't lost in all those numbers, that is a pretty big difference. It's enough of a difference that one, that retailers will, realtors will advertise it as part of trying to sell a house. Now, additionally, this is not an issue specific to Multnomah County. In a different county in 2013, two houses, both sold for approximately $160,000. House A's owner paid $3,273 in annual property taxes. House B owners paid $2,280 in property taxes annually. Again, I think that's a pretty significant difference. There's also an example I could provide that took place in Bend, where a home sold in 2010, but I think you're all beginning to get this picture. Colleagues, this is wrong. A tax system that operates like this is wrong. These disparities are most harmful, in my opinion, to BIPOC Oregonians, often prevented from home ownership. When property taxes shifted from real market value to assessed value, the process of gentrification, it was amplified when white Oregonians, particularly in my area of the world, were able to lock in low assessed values on homes that they were buying in traditionally black neighborhoods where people of color were driven out. This joint resolution or ballot measure, should you refer it, would allow Oregonians to decide if the assessed value should be 75% of the real market value, which would allow the assessed value to shift as the real market value does, ensuring a more equitable property tax system that is more aligned with what the home's actual value is. I think it's important to note that this change of assessed value would be on a 5-year ramp-in timeline, allowing for property taxpayers to adjust over a period of time. And in short, Madam Chair, that means that increases that might come with a fair property tax system would be phased in so that property taxpayers who might see their taxes go up will not see them go up so dramatically all at once. Now, I'll admit, this might not be the best solution that you all are looking for, but I'm hopeful that this approach and this bill opens up a dialogue in this committee about our property tax structure and how it's currently failing many Oregonians in terms of fairness and changes that need to be made. I'm hopeful that your staff, Madam Chair, are prepared to eloquently present more in more detail what our property tax system looks like. And I'm going to gladly turn it over to them since I'm supposed to be in a work group trying to figure out how to save the Oregon Health Plan. But I'd be happy to entertain an easy question or two if you have any, Madam Chair.
Easy questions?
Easy question. There aren't really that many in taxes, but.
Yeah. Committee, any questions? Any questions for Representative Nose? Otherwise, we will hear from Mr. Alanak in a moment. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Nose, for bringing this forward. My easy question for you today is, where do you get that tie?
Men's Warehouse, $10 on sale when I went to a wedding.
All right, thank you.
All right, that is pretty easy. Okay, I really do need to be doing something else, Madam Chair, but as I confess, I've been a property tax nerd for a long time, and this is an important discussion, and I'm glad your committee is taking it up.
Thank you for being with us.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
I'm gonna do a little housekeeping now. Committee, we don't have any other legislators signed up, but in the public testimony, we do have a mayor who is with us. So first I would like to hear, usually we have the bill presented briefly from Legislative Revenue Office. I would like Mr. Alanak to present the bill briefly for us, and then we will hear next from Mayor Pete Truax, and then the rest. So, Mr. Alanak.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So the way the resolution is currently drafted, it does take this ratio of AMV, assessed value to real market value, and set it to 0.75. As I think committee members are aware, this ratio is all over the map for different kinds of properties and different geographic locations. And In addition to setting it at 0.75, it provides a five-year ramp to get properties to that ratio. The resolution also has a homestead exemption. Now, I would encourage the members and stakeholders listening to view this as kind of a starting point, or maybe just another point in the continuation of discussion regarding property tax reform. There are a number of technical issues related to the issue, which is one category. So for members of the House Revenue Committee, you get to wear two hats. One are the technical issues related to the policy, and then also the policy consequences. And there are broad issues in both of those that will hopefully come out in testimony and discussions as the committee moves on. So I would encourage you to focus on the big picture of the policy intent here, which is really this ratio, which is a key metric within the system. And this ratio basically is the percentage of real market value that is subject to taxation. So in terms of the examples that Representative Nose was describing, the issue, one way to view this from an equity lens is, for every home, residential home in Oregon, what percent of that home's real market value should be subject to the property tax? Every time this ratio is different, it means that that percentage of taxable value is different. So that factors into some of those discussions. And one of the challenges for the committee is the trade-off in the interaction between the taxpayer and local governments. So moving everybody to a 0.75 would decrease taxes for some in some areas and increase taxes in other areas. So immediately you see the playoff between the challenge of, you know, to making something taxpayer friendly and lowering the taxes. There's the impact on local governments. And then conversely, raising the taxes, having taxpayers pay more in tax, while simultaneously helping, if you will, local government revenue. So those counterbalancing forces are really what we're hoping you can take away and further this discussion. Not to minimize any of the technical issues, because you do have language and a resolution before you. But some of those bigger issues are what we're hoping to move forward in the property tax reform discussion.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Alanek, I'm trying to remember, we've had a couple of presentations on property taxes over the years, and I believe there was one presentation that had a chart based on county of what the average ratio was for property tax. I was unable to find it in my notes. I'm just wondering if that's something that LRO could point me to as I look further into this resolution.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Reschke, I believe that slide is contained. We pulled it forward into one of the meeting materials under HJR 13. There is a document called CPR update, and there's a slide there. So if we get to a point where Chair Nathanson wants us to go through the slides, there are three slides in there, and there's one slide that has all 36 counties. It's kind of a statistical chart, but it really does highlight the problem in a statistical way, which is, I think, what you're referring to. It's something that Jamie went over during the property tax orientation. Also in the meeting materials is an old LRO report from 2010 that dealt with this issue. So depending on the time, Madam Chair, for testimony, we can maybe come back to that or whenever you would like.
Thank you.
Representative Reschke, is it all right with you if we proceed with public testimony, and then if there's time before the end of the meeting, we can look at those slides? Otherwise, we can look at them another day.
That's fine. Let's do the public testimony.
Thank you. Okay, we have eight more speakers. After Mayor Pete Truax, we will hear from Jody Weiser, Sean Gillians, Sean Cleave, Scott Bruin, Mark Garst, and Bennett Minton. And then Josie's the last. Okay, so Mayor Truax.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Pete Truax. I'm the mayor of the city of Forest Grove, and I'm also chair of the Metropolitan Mayors Consortium. The MMC represents the mayors of some 24 cities in the Portland metropolitan area. That's home to some 1.7 million Oregonians. And I'm here to testify on behalf of the MMC in support of HJR 13. As you're all aware, Oregon's property tax system is outdated and inequitable. During the 2019 session, I testified on behalf of the MMC in support of Senate Joint Resolution 21, which would have created a floor of 0.75 for the ratio of assessed property value to real market value. Now, that bill never passed out of a committee, and in 2 years since that hearing, our state has taken no meaningful steps towards improving the equity of our property tax system. HJR 13 makes a similar proposition to SJR 21. The bill proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution by requiring the ratio of maximum assessed value to real market value to be at least 0.75. As a constitutional amendment, this bill would refer this proposal to voters in the next regular general election, leaving the future of Oregon's property tax system to be determined by the will of the people. Now, Representative Noce has already shared the Dickens-like tale of two houses in the metropolitan Portland area, and I'm sure that goes around the state. In most of our state, property is taxed for significantly less than its real market value, about 35% less statewide. In the metro area, and particularly in recently gentrified and rapidly growing neighborhoods, property is often taxed at 30 to 50% of real market value. In these neighborhoods where property values have rapidly increased in recent years, lower income people and communities of color are often displaced and forced to move to areas where property values have increased more slowly. This results in many low-income Oregonians paying proportionately more in property taxes than the very individuals who have displaced them from their rapidly gentrifying neighborhoods. This displacement also has the factor of often increasing such things as commute times from home to work for many of these people, and that, again, is another equity issue. Especially because Oregon does not have a sales tax, local governments and our education system rely heavily on property tax revenues. At a time when the real estate market is booming, the legislature is hearing story after story about insufficient funding for public health, behavioral health, and other vital social services. By taxing much of the property across the state, and particularly in the metropolitan area, at only a fraction of its value, cities, counties, and the state are foregoing a significant amount of revenue, that could be spent on supporting our community members who are most in need. Now, in Forest Grove, for example, we have to rely on a five-year local option levy to support our public safety requirements. Without that levy, our permanent levy is not sufficient to meet police, fire, and emergency medical needs. That does not even begin to address other basic city responsibilities, such as parks, such as libraries. Under HJR 13, property taxes would only increase for individuals whose property value has risen dramatically since the implementation of Measure 50 back in 1996. You're already paying property taxes at least 75% of the real market value of your property. Your taxes do not change. The bill also includes a homestead exemption for low-income property owners. The mayors of the MMC asked the legislature to support HJR 13, which takes a small first step towards creating a more equitable property tax system in the state of Oregon. Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. Answer any questions. I hope to answer any questions that you have some.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we will hear from Jody Weiser.
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, my name is Jody Weiser, and I'm speaking on behalf of Tax Fairness Oregon. You often hear from John Bennett and I testifying before your committee. This bill will change our taxes dramatically, and we think it's a great idea. We are concerned, our three homes vary in value from a half million to over a million, but our taxes bear no relationship to the values of our home. John's home was in the Southwest Hills in a better neighborhood in 1995. Mine was out in the country, and I had to have a well and a septic system, but now I could have four more homes on my property. And Bennett's home was in a neighborhood full of gang warfare and drive-by shootings, etc. So Bennett now pays taxes on 13% of the assessor's real market value. I pay on 36% of the assessor's real market value, and John pays on 86%. John's taxes would go down, and Bennett's and mine would go up. Both of us should be paying significantly more in taxes than we are because of the services we receive. HJR 13 would bring these differences into alignment with Oregon's tax fairness goals, which I have included in my written testimony for you. We are, however, concerned about the $25,000 homestead exemption. We think it would prove damaging to jurisdictions where $25,000 would be a significant percentage of a home's values. And therefore, you would see communities where that exemption would actually damage the local community. And there would be other places, for instance, the metro area, where the appreciation has been so high that many of our taxes are well below the 75%, and the exemption wouldn't matter. So we think that while that might be a helpful idea to sell a bill to the public, it's the unfairness that it would create in our tax system for differing jurisdictions would be not be worth it. There are wild inequities like Bennett's, John's, and mine, not just in homes, but in commercial properties as well. I think you'll remember the examples of the gas stations from a couple of years ago. We hope that you really will take this bill into deep consideration. It's time to do something about the unfairness of our property tax system. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. Next, we will hear from Sean Jillians.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Realtors today. In opposition to all the provisions that Mr. Alanak put in. No, just kidding. I did love how Chris said, don't worry, stakeholders, this is just a starting point. And I think that's exactly why we have signed up as neutral on the bill. We have talked for a great deal of time, particularly in the Senate with former Chair Haas about property tax reform and what that might look like, and ultimately what provisions we could see going out to the voters and ultimately being approved. As you heard from previous testimony, it's the will of the voters if they decide on this. It's also the will of the voters, the current system we have, which was approved rather overwhelmingly in a series of elections, as you all know, in the 90s, giving us our current system. Not a huge surprise to you all. We are supportive of a homestead exemption. A number of other states do that to incentivize homeownership and sort of equalize out the property tax burden. While I wish that $25,000 was a significant portion of any assessed home in the state of Oregon, those days have passed us by. There's not a single community in our state where that would make up even 25% of real market value of a home these days. And when we talk about the Portland region, I've just pulled the numbers for the median home price of sales in Portland. We're at almost $520,000. So affordability certainly is a huge issue in our state. We think a homestead exemption could be beneficial there. We have talked repeatedly over the years about a revenue neutral reform to take out the inequities, but to not see a dramatic increase in costs. I think the examples given by Representative Nose of two property owners and someone paying at a very, very low rate, if that individual were a fixed income individual, and you're talking about hundreds of percents of increase in their property tax bills 5 years, simply is not enough and would be extremely detrimental. So we'd like to see the glide path, if there are going to be significant increases for people, be longer than that. And obviously increasing the homestead exemption would be something that we would be supportive of. On that note, the previous bills have sort of laid out that the legislature will establish one, but not put it in the Constitution. We would recommend that you all put it in the Constitution, so when this goes out to the voters, they know exactly what they're getting when they vote to approve it or not. With that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer questions. Certainly look forward to working on further details as the bill progresses.
Thank you for the testimony. The next two speakers, Sean Cleave, followed by Scott Bruin.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, this is Sean Cleave representing the Taxpayers Association of Oregon. Thank you for having me today. And Madam Chair, if you'd permit me, my three daughters are at home with grandma watching the hearing, and I'd like to say hi to them. This is their civics class for the day, and they've always asked, what does daddy do? And now they know. We Taxpayers Association of Oregon is opposing the piece of legislation, HJR 13. We do recognize, however, that there are some inequities that go on with the system. I think that if you were to look at all 50 states and their property tax system, there would obviously be 50 problems or 50 inequities that go along with those systems. Fairness is definitely one of those pieces I hear a lot of as a father of three little girls. As taxes go, they're either too high or too low, never that Goldilocks area of taxation. I don't think I've ever heard somebody say, boy, that tax is just right. With that, Madam Chair, I know that having worked with Mr. Jillians from the realtor's perspective, they are interested in having this conversation, but the real challenge becomes the referral to the people of Oregon. I'm very fond of saying two things are the death nail in legislation: controversy, first and foremost, and complexity. And this bill has both of those components, Madam Chair. With that, I will wrap up my testimony and thank you again for my indulgence.
Thank you. And we're delighted to have civics students with us today watching. Next, Scott Bruin.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Pham and Reschke, and Revenue Committee members. My name is Scott Bruin, and I am Director of Tax and Fiscal Policy for Oregon Business and Industry. OBI is a member-led business trade association. We have 1,600 members that employ about 330,000 Oregonians. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. We are opposed to HJR 13 for several reasons. First, we oppose HJR 13 because it is regressive. The swift acceleration of property taxes that would happen under HJR 13 by tying tax assessed value at 75% of market value is inherently regressive. Even the five-year phase-in aspect would not protect lower or fixed income property of taxpayers. We have seen too many wild gyrations in market valuations over recent years for this to work without causing significant hardships, perhaps insurmountable hardships, for some taxpayers. Respectfully, among the necessary attributes of good tax policy is the ability for taxpayers to understand and predict what their future tax burdens may be with a reasonable degree of certainty. Otherwise, forward-looking planning and decision-making become virtually impossible. HJR 13, fully implemented, allows for none of the taxpayer certainty necessary for good tax policy, and it will erode taxpayer confidence. And of course, it's not just personal property and payers affected, it's also business property and payers. Think about those gem but not flashy small businesses that you can find tucked away even in denser urban areas. Boutique manufacturing shops, cabinet shops, auto repair shops, you name it. They are all over Southeast and Northeast Portland, Eugene and Corvallis, just for a few examples. Regardless whether those businesses lease or own the properties they work from, they are the type of businesses that would be hurt most by a system called for in HJR 13. More simply put, HDR 13 would accelerate gentrification. Lower fixed income families and lower margin businesses will be the ones most negatively affected. They are the ones most at risk of being priced right out of their own neighborhoods. Secondly, we oppose HDR 13 because it once again raises Oregon's overall tax burden. It is important to remember from a business perspective that the overall business tax burden has gone up significantly in recent years. In fact, the Oregon tax burden study compiled by the Council on State Taxation, Ernst & Young, shows that tax increases passed by the legislature in 2019 will raise business tax burden by 41% by 2022 when those increases are fully phased in. This will move Oregon from the 40th highest in the nation in overall business tax burden to 19th highest in a very short period of time. Adding a major property tax increase or any other tax increase can only have a debilitating effect on Oregon's businesses and their ability to grow, to invest, to hire, to retain employees, and to compete with businesses outside of Oregon. Finally, we oppose HDR 13 because it would actually complicate the necessary work of reforms for our property tax system. Our system as it stands today is not without fault, and the business community understands a conversation around property tax reform is needed. But HDR 13, a regressive split roll system tied to market price volatility, is not the direction we should go. Better would be to tackle the issue of property tax reform by convening stakeholders for a top to bottom review, analysis, and recommendations. And we believe this is work best done in the interim. For these reasons, Madam Chair and Committee, we oppose HDR 13. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. Committee, before we get too far along, have there been any questions for the speakers that we've already been through? We still have a few more. Okay. Next, Mark Garst, please.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the League of Oregon Cities. First of all, I just want to say thank you very much to Rep. Nose for bringing this bill forward and for, you know, trying to move the ball on this important conversation. I marked that we're neutral on the bill, and I think that it's really more appropriate to say that we would be seeking to amend the bill. Property tax reform is a longstanding priority for the League of Oregon Cities. The property tax system brought in $7.5 billion in the 2019-20 fiscal year, and about 20% of that money went to cities. It is our number one source of revenue. Working through our policy committee and recognizing that there would be a conversation with stakeholders that would need to take place, our board did not adopt a specific system that we would like to see adopted, but rather we adopted a set of principles that we would like you to think about as you consider reform. We'd be interested in either incremental or systematic reform. We want a reform that gives local choice. We're not looking for a large statewide tax increase right out of the box. It's really going to depend on the needs of various communities. Some of them need additional revenue, some of them may not. We would like to see equity in the system. We'd like to see folks' burden tied to the value of their property. This is a wealth tax, after all. And generally, property taxes do not have to be, you know, regressive necessarily. Generally, the higher the value of the asset, the higher the tax, and we would consider that to be generally a progressive system. I know there are some issues on the lower end. We would like the system to have fairness. And so we would definitely want to think about the impact of the system that the change would have on individual taxpayers. Certainly, you know, some of the comments that have been made are well taken. There are folks in inner Northeast and Southeast Portland who maybe are on a limited income, have been in those neighborhoods a very long time, and we certainly would not want to see them priced out of their home. So we think that, you know, we would need to think about property tax relief as an important part of any reform package. Also, we like the idea of a phase-in. We think that that could really, you know, we wouldn't want to see a huge spike right out of the box. Finally, we'd be interested in a system that promoted adequacy. And what we think of there is just that the system will fund the services that the local community desires, the services that our residents are demanding of us. So LOC wants to be a partner in this conversation. We're already active in some conversations that are happening around the state, and we would be happy to come before the committee at any time that would make sense to you, Chair Nathanson, and have a conversation about, you know, what we see in the property tax system. That being said, on the specifics of the bill, and I know that Chris kind of warned us not to get too far into it, but I do think it's instructive for, you know, the conversation around reform to think about what the bill would do. It would kind of push folks either up or down towards that 75% ratio between the maximum assessed value and the real market value. And certainly that would work in some places. Certainly it would drive us towards equity, which would be good. So it would meet one of our goals. But there are, you know, on the chart that Rep. Reschke mentioned, that box and whiskers chart, you'll see that there are, you know, I think probably a dozen counties right now where the residential property is already taxed at a number that's well above 75%. And so what that means is that this would be a tax decrease in those counties. And so that would be problematic, obviously. It would not meet the adequacy test. And, you know, you could work on this by maybe modifying, you've got a new base now, so maybe you could change the permanent rates to account for that new base. Or you could have it be more like a floor where you just say it can't be below the 75%. So a change like that could make this language maybe workable. Additionally, as Chris kind of mentioned, you know, there are a lot of property types that are currently well above that 75% number. So you think about your centrally assessed property, you think about business, personal property, those are depreciating assets. So generally the real market value that you'll see on the roll is, again, well below that maximum assessed value. The maximum assessed value was set, and then the real market value has declined due to depreciation. So again, this would be a property tax break for those types of property. And so, you know, there are ways to address it. You could only have the bill apply to residential property, or again, you could have it be a floor and not a maximum. But there would need to be a change if you didn't want to create a large tax break and maybe, you know, cut off some revenues that are desperately needed in some of our communities. Finally, on the homestead exemption, just the same point, you know, in a lot of communities, we're already above that 75% number. And so, especially for communities that are heavily dependent on residential property as a part of their tax base, you know, this could have a catastrophic effect on revenues. So any solution that we come up with is going to need to be workable statewide. And I'm confident that we can get there. People love to say it's complicated, but, you know, you all are a very smart group of people. And I don't doubt for a second that we can come up with a solution that will work for folks. I mean, the bottom line is that our property tax system is broken. It's been 20 to 30 years since these ballot measures were passed, and we've seen what all the effects that have been mentioned so far, horizontal inequity. We have just radical differences in permanent rates across various jurisdictions. 36 of our cities have a rate less than a dollar. 71 cities a rate from $1 to $3. 69 cities, $3 to $5. 49 cities, $5 to $7, and 17 cities above $7 permanent rate. And these cities are supposed to often provide very similar services. So how does that work? Many of them are just pushed to increasing fees in order to fund these services, and fees are regressive in the way that they're applied. They will hit lower income folks harder. So that's certainly something that we need to look at. And then obviously compression is a big issue. You guys have heard about it. I won't belabor it. We lost $121 million in the last fiscal year to compression, and there are certain districts that are highly compressed. So measures 5 and 50 are constitutional. As has been discussed, whatever we come up with has to get through the voters. Because of how differences have played out across the state, it may not be the same message that applies to voters across the state. It may be that we need different messages. Certainly in Multnomah County, the effects that the system, the way the system's played out with gentrification and the effects that it's had on the BIPOC community, that's a very significant issue. But there are other communities that just haven't seen that kind of radical appreciation in their real estate values. And those concerns maybe are not going to hit home as much for those folks. Maybe for those folks, what we're talking about is just a local choice, the ability to fund a service that they might want or a particular need that they have in their community that they've recognized. And so, you know, it may be that we need different messages for different folks. Finally, we certainly don't want to see any more opposition to any reform package than is necessary. And, you know, we certainly heard, you know, the folks from the business community today, and we know that there are concerns. And we're not looking to make Oregon a less business-friendly state. You know, we certainly think that we need to work together to come up with something that makes sense for everybody. But there are certainly effects of the property tax system currently that are not good for businesses. You know, the Tale of Two Gas Stations was mentioned. That was some work that my predecessor did, just demonstrating that there are direct competitors business-wise to one another who have the same issue, radically different tax bills with a relatively similar valued property. And that doesn't do anything for good competition among businesses, and it's not fair to them either. So I'll leave it there. I really appreciate the conversation, Representative Nathanson, and to you for scheduling this bill. We think that this is a very valuable conversation. And again, we would be willing to come back at any point. I have a couple folks who put on a presentation. They're called the Property Tax Nerds. They do it at our conference. It's a really kind of great presentation about the property tax system and how it's played out. And we'd be happy to do that or anything else that you may feel would be helpful.
Thank you for the testimony. Representative Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question for Mark, as well as maybe Chris, it's because Mark, you mentioned something that I saw in an LRO report as well about horizontal inequities. In 2010, the LRO, can you hear me okay?
You're a little soft, but I can hear you.
Okay. I'm going to try speaking very loudly into the computer. So in the LRO report in 2010, it said that when general home price, this is something that was published in the meeting materials, I think. When general home price appreciation begins again, horizontal inequities can be expected to grow over time. And, you know, I think it said this is because the recovery will be uneven and certain regions will grow more rapidly than others. This report was released right after the Great Recession, and it showed that Measure 50 contributes to widening horizontal inequities. So we're going through another period of recovery from, you know, another economic crisis. Would we expect more horizontal inequities to grow if we do not address this issue with Measure 50? And Mark, I don't know if you have an assessment of, like, if we don't take action, how do you, you mentioned horizontal inequities, how do you think they will change? As well as Chris, if you have any answers given the LRO's report.
Rep. Nathanson, would you like me to respond?
Very briefly, we have other people waiting to testify. You might want to respond briefly, and then it's also a question that we might want to ask LRO to address. And by the way, Representative Marsh joined us a long time ago. She wasn't here at the very beginning of the meeting, but I wanted to acknowledge for people who are listening to our meeting, Representative Marsh is with us and has been with us for quite a while. Go ahead, Mr. Garst.
So Chair Nathanson, Rep. Pham, yeah, I think that that's exactly, you know, what we would expect to see. You know, the bottom line is that different neighborhoods appreciate at different rates. And the longer that we have this current system, we can expect that the horizontal inequities will grow just by virtue of that very fact. If I, you know, live in a rapidly appreciating neighborhood and my maximum assessed value can only go up 3% a year, and another person lives in a slower appreciating neighborhood, and again, their math can only go up 3% a year, that just means that over time, we're gonna get further apart as far as what our taxes are relative to the real market value of that property.
Thank you. And I would love to make sure we have time to see, as Rep. Reschke was mentioning, the slide from the CPR, I think, was really eye-opening to see some of the differential impacts. I have a question about rural counties versus urban counties. I'll let the other testifiers go. Thank you, Chair Nathanson.
Thank you. Next, we'll hear from Bennett Minton.
Madam Chair, once again, can you hear me?
Just fine.
Great. I am Bennett Minton. I live in Portland. I'm speaking on my own behalf. I offer a different tack from what I've heard. Several decades ago, Americans began to buy into the idea that government should, as was said, live within its means just like families do. The related notion was that taxes should be limited to some arbitrary amount, just as households make do. This is a false picture of how thriving governments, businesses, and households make budgets. It is, rather, the prescription for failure. Every successful entity operates with a vision. What does it want to be, and how does it become that? Then it attracts the required resources. Thriving, future-oriented families set visions and work to achieve them. We learn new skills to raise our value, or we take a second job. We borrow for our children's education. We take out mortgages. To start a business, we borrow or bring in partners or distribute equity. Decades ago, Oregon voters restricted property taxes by imposing backward-looking constitutional limits. The result is an arcane system with no rational principle, nor the ability to meet the needs arrived at democratically. Allow me to illustrate. When I bought my house in 2018, the sidewalk in front had been buckled by a tree in the median, posing a danger to pedestrians. Years earlier, the city had shifted to homeowners' responsibility for sidewalks. Many of them are crumbling. A few months after we moved in, my wife and I were walking home from dinner when she tripped over a broken sidewalk and did a face plant in the dark. We have inadequate streetlights, too. Her injuries cost us a couple $1,000s in medical bills. The city ordinance allows us to sue the adjacent homeowner. But if you saw the house, you'd think twice about the chance of collecting, assuming you want to spend your time suing your neighbors. After I removed, at my expense, the city's tree, it wasn't my tree, I had the sidewalk rebuilt for $4,000. But what would be my share of having the city maintain the sidewalk for the whole block so that no one does a face plant? And what would be the social effect of having our infrastructure maintained as if we, all of us, cared? The sidewalk has value only because it connects the neighborhood. It's part of what makes the city a city. I appreciate the intent of the resolution, which is to address some of the inequities in our property tax. I'm no purist, and Rep. Nose deserves credit for the effort. As Jody Weiser suggested, I assume my taxes would rise under his reform, and that's fine. To the extent gentrification is taking place, and it is in Albina, where I live, I'm a beneficiary. Albina would likely gentrify even with a fairer system. But I doubt HJR 13 is the solution. The solution is simple, though executing it, of course, is not. In Virginia, where I lived before moving to Oregon, the property tax has two elements, the rate and the assessed value. The rate goes up and down, corresponding to value, after the locality determines the budget. The budget determines the tax, not the other way around. That's why Scott Brune's contention that tax bills would gyrate is unlikely. As long as Oregon maintains tax constraints destructive to its vision, our governments cannot address our needs, among them sidewalks, streetlights, housing, trash collection, and earthquake preparedness. Oregon has astonishing attractions. That's why I'm here. Natural beauty, entrepreneurial spirit, libertarian instincts. It also has dead weight. The property tax is a marker of a failing state, stuck in a mythic past rather than embracing an abundant future. Until we dispatch the notion that tax policy should be so arbitrary, we will continue our descent, separate and unequal. Thank you.
Thank you. And the final person to testify today is Josie Kuna.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. Chair Nathanson, members of the House Committee on Revenue, my name is Josie Kerner. I am here, you know, on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and we are testifying in support of this bill. The League of Women Voters of Oregon believes in fair, equitable, and stable tax and revenue policies to adequately fund services and functions critical to Oregonians. Measure 5 and 50 have greatly hampered the ability for counties and local districts to generate enough revenue for services and establish the system of assessed values rather than levy on ad valorem taxes that are more in, alignment with real market values. These measures set the property taxes back to 1995 real market values minus 10%. So as you've heard, during a period of fast rising property taxes, these artificially froze the property taxes to 1995 that can only go up 3% per year. This is irregardless of whether the real property value greatly increased or decreased. So the HJR 13 is a creative solution although probably not the end ultimate solution to property tax problems. HHJR would bring these values closer together and a far more equitable way to tax property. It establishes a ratio between the maximum assessed value of property to the real market value, which must be increased or decreased to 0.75 over 5 years. So that if the ratio is greater than 0.75, 3/4, the maximum assessed value of the assessed value would be raised. And if they are declining, the assessed value would also decline. The ratio is phased in gradually, starting with an increase of just 20% of the MAV to RAV ratio the first year and increasing by 20% each year thereafter till you get to the full ratio. After these adjustments, the property taxes would be more equitably stabilized. In addition to the first 25,000 indexed to inflation of the real market value of the homestead would be exempt starting in July 23. This provision benefits the owners of the lower priced homes. In addition, we urge you to support this measure. We think it's a creative solution that will move us in the right direction towards a more balanced solution. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. Do any of you have questions for the last several speakers? At this time, Mr. Alanak, we do have a few minutes left. Would you like to show us some slides to help illustrate some of the points that are being made while we're still in our public hearing?
Yes, Madam Chair. So we just in the last couple of minutes here, again, in the meeting material, there's something called CPR update. And within there on slide 2, I think has been referenced a couple of times. And I think this was part of Jamie's orientation. So I think if it's okay, Madam Chair, with you, if Jamie walks through this slide, because this is a slide that covers all 36 counties and kind of gets at the idea one way that if equity, then each one of these little graphs for each county should be identical. So I think Jamie's here.
Chair Nathanson, this is Jamie McGovern.
We can hear you.
Thank goodness. I had a little bit of trouble earlier on. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, this is Jamie McGovern, the Legislative Revenue Office. I think we have staff that could bring up that slide in our meeting materials in presentation. Okay, great. So this, okay, just to a little bit of a caveat, this data is a couple of years old. We have a lag in the property tax system, but this was part of the property tax presentation, and so we were just using a slide that we had worked on before. And what we have here is these long vertical lines for each individual county. And what that says is for each county, you can see there's an upper and lower bound, and that's the long vertical line. And so essentially it goes all the way from almost 0% of the property value to up to 100% of the property value is what we see people paying their property taxes on. So there's a wide range. Of assessed values in relation to the real market value. But the majority or half of the properties are in that rectangular box. So that is a way of focusing on the sort of center 25% on each side of what we think of as the median. So there's a middle property value ratio, and that would be that horizontal line in the middle of the box. There's some like small technical differences between the diamond and the horizontal line, but that's essentially the middle there. And then you've got some properties a little bit above and a little bit below. If you have a really tall box, I guess is the way to say it. What that means is you've got more properties that have their ratios in comparison with the RMV spread out.
Ms. McGovern, I think it would be helpful to us. I think when you're referring to a tall box, it would be, for example, on number 18. Absolutely. Is that correct? And then a short box would be more like number 9.
Absolutely. So, Chair Nathanson, I'm sorry, I was somewhat vague. So, for instance, a tall box would be county number 18, which is Klamath County, but also county 26, which is Multnomah County. So it doesn't have to be high up. It just is a wide box or a tall box, I guess. But a county that maybe, for instance, is more condensed, like Deschutes County, what that means is you have a very concentrated set of assessed values to real market values. In those counties where the boxes are tiny or close, you know, short, what you can think of is there's less disparity. More properties are paying similar proportions of their real market value. And in this set of graphs, we're looking at residential properties. We can have similar graphs for other types of properties, but we look at one property type, property class type at a time. And in the case of Multnomah County, for instance, or the case of Klamath County, you see property values in assessed values in relation to the real market values that are much more spread out. And then let's talk about, say, for instance, County 23. So if we're looking at Malheur County, or we're looking at Harney County, which are very close to one, what that means is the majority of people there are paying property taxes on a value that is very close to their real market value. Now, that isn't a comment on the disparity within those property taxpayers, but the level, they're paying around, say, 90% of their real market value instead of on, say, you know, Multnomah County looks like about 50%. Now, some people... would it be okay if we looked at another slide very quickly, since we have two more slides in this? Or would you like to?
Sure, that's fine. And committee, I did want to let you know that I'm getting a signal that in a couple of minutes, I'm going to be stepping out of this room to go to another hearing room. And when you see me leave, Rep. Pham has the gavel. Rep. Pham, though, has a question.
Absolutely. Right. Representative Pham, I cannot hear you. I apologize. I think you may be on mute.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Can you hear me now?
I can. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. McGovern. I had a question just to make sure I'm understanding this right. It looks like that based on this slide, if the HJR was adopted, that homeowners in metro urban counties would likely pay more in property taxes, while property owners in more rural counties would likely pay less. Is that a correct assessment?
So, Representative Pham, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, there's a lot more going on here for me to be able to answer that question. Part of that is the budgets that was mentioned. Another part of that is the Measure 5 constraints. And this, I will point out, we're talking about individual properties. This doesn't necessarily account for the property values. So we don't know, for instance, if the more expensive properties are the properties that are high up or lower. In general, you might say that in these more urban areas, people are sort of would be moving up. But I can't say that for sure because there's a lot of factors going on.
Thank you.
Okay. And then I'm just thinking that if it's okay that we move to the next slide really quick and then and then we can move to the following slide. Okay, so this is Multnomah County. And so just to give a little bit of picture of the disparity, and I know we're short for time, so I'm not going to focus that much on the table on the right-hand side, which would calculate people's individual taxes. But in the graph, this is actually a histogram looking at just Multnomah County. And what this says is, if you can see that we're sort of hovering, there's the peak around, you know, one third or 0.33 or 0.366. What that says is there's a lot of properties where the individual owners are paying on about a third of their property value. And then there's very few that are paying on like almost zero, and there's very few that are paying on about 100%. And there's also another bump, a significant portion of property owners that are paying on about 65% of their property value. So this gives you an idea of the percentage of property owners that are paying in the different proportions of their real market value. And I'm going to move to
And before you move to the next slide, could you back up one for just a minute? I'm going to get in a question before I leave.
Absolutely.
There may not be any good answer or information for this question. Can we back up one slide?
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks. So when you look at, some counties are very close to one, and some are at varying degrees less, you know, a lot less or a little less. Is there any relationship between county assessment and reassessment activities? You know, the degree to which they're caught up on work or how they do their work. Is there any relationship between that and where we see the boxes appear on the line?
Chair Nathanson, off the top of my head, I was not prepared for that. And so I'd have to get back. That's a little bit of homework. A related response to that is that the counties where the boxes are higher up would mean that when new properties come on the roll, that the counties are able to collect property taxes on a higher percentage of the real market value of the new properties as compared to the counties that have the sort of boxes in the lower portions. Because they would be assessed at the new properties would be coming on the roll at a lower assessed value than they would be if they were located in a different county.
Thank you. And Representative Marsh has a question.
Thank you. Jamie, I don't expect you to be able to answer this, but any comments that you have, I would be welcome. So I was thinking about this in terms of Jackson County, which is my county and looks pretty stable there, hanging out at the 0.75. measure. And I looked up on another computer my own house, which is accelerated in real market value because we just had a wildfire that wiped out 2,500 housing units and our real estate market is going crazy. What this makes me think about is the gap between real market values and corresponding increases in people's income. And I wondered, because obviously that is a problem with anything that presses the assessed values to increase in concert with the real market values is whether or not that actually reflects more money in people's pockets. And I just wondered if you had any comments about that or whether it's possible to make any generalizations from this chart in terms of the ability of people to afford their property taxes.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, thank you. I will say that, you know, as Chris mentioned, this resolution is in moving forward the conversation around property tax reform. I'll say that the measure or the resolution as it's written wouldn't address that component that you are speaking of, which is the, you know, sort of affordability of a long-term asset once you've bought into it and either a stagnant or fluctuating income while the real market value of your house may change. Other states do look at those kinds of things through reset at sale and various mechanisms. So, you know, the house, once you purchase a house, and it's a long-term asset, if there are fluctuations, the way that this resolution is written, it doesn't necessarily, address that interaction between that and your income. But we can do a little more research and see what's out there.
Thank you so much, Jamie.
Thank you, Marsh. Okay, thanks. And I think we have, if we skip to the last slide, just to give everybody interpretation, not to claim that one particular percentage value is better than another, just to give an idea of what it means to have a set of RMB ratios, AV RMB ratios, or what it might look like if you had one single one. So the idea is if you had the graph over on the left and every single property taxpayer was paying on 100% of their real market value in those bubble graphs and histograms that I gave before, like this line up straight up and down is what you would have. Now, what that could occur from in a theoretical world is when we started our property tax system back in 1997, and as it was mentioned, pegged it to the 95-96 values, if real market values never diverged from the 3% or the assessed value after that, you might literally be along this line for everybody. So an AMV-RMV ratio of 1 isn't necessarily undesirable or desirable. It just means that it has been moving in sync with the property tax system, which is the 3%, or it could have been moving in sync with the 3% assessed value trajectory that is set in our Constitution. And then the other graph is just showing a little bit of what it might look like over that 5-year phase-in trajectory of what House Joint Resolution 13 has, where you saw the one with Multnomah County where there were these sort of lumps and this wide spread out dispersion of property taxpayers, whereas in moving towards one solid line that looks like the left-hand graph over the 5-year trajectory, you might see something that's more like the graph on the right, which is phasing that in up until the year 2027. And I think that's what I have for that. I'm happy to take questions.
Representative Marsh, do you have another question?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I do not.
Rep Pham, I'm handing this over to you now.
Speaking of News 10, I hope everyone's happy.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I will. We have just about 5 minutes left. Does anybody else have any questions about the slides that Jamie just presented? With that, seeing no questions, I will close this public hearing for HJR 13. Chris, are there any other things that you think we should raise before we close this meeting?
Madam Chair, in the interest of time, I'll go with the answer no, but I've taken a lot of notes in there. I do actually have a lot of comments, but I think it kind of sets up the continuing conversation for the committee to be addressed at another time. I wouldn't want to shortchange any of the issues and questions that have been raised today.
Thank you, Chris. I look forward to this ongoing discussion. This is very rich and educational. Okay, well, with that, then I will adjourn this meeting. Thank you all for the presentations and discussion. Bye, everyone.